say, Crumb reckoned that symbol was carved on a wall at Durmstrang, and Grindelwald put it there. She fell back into the old armchair, frowning. That's very odd. If it's a symbol of dark magic, what's it doing in a book of children's stories? Yeah, it is weird, said Harry, and you'd think Scrimgeour would have recognized it. He was minister. He ought to have been expert on dark stuff. I know. Perhaps he thought it was an eye, just like I did. All the other stories have little pictures over the titles. She did not speak, but continued to pore over the strange mark. Harry tried again. Hermione? I've been thinking. I want to go to Godric's Hollow. She looked up at him, but her eyes were unfocused, and he was sure she was still thinking about the mysterious mark on the book. Yes, she said. Yes, I've been wondering that too. I really think we'll have to. Did you hear me right? He asked. Of course I did. You want to go to Godric's Hollow. I agree, I think we should. I mean, I can't think of anywhere else it could be either. It'll be dangerous, but the more I think about it, the more likely it seems it's there.
What's there? Asked Harry. At that, she looked just as bewildered as he felt.
Well, the sword, Harry. Dumbledore must have known you'd want to go back there, and I mean, Godric's Hollow is Godric Gryffindor's birthplace.
Really? Gryffindor came from Godric's Hollow?
Harry, did you ever even open A History of Magic?
He said, smiling for what felt like the first time in months. The muscles in his face felt oddly stiff.
I might have opened it, you know, when I bought it. Just the once. Well, as the village is named after him, I'd have thought you might have made the connection, said Hermione.
She sounded much more like her old self than she had done of late. Harry half expected her to announce that she was off to the library.
There's a bit about the village in A History of Magic. Wait.
She opened the beaded bag and rummaged for a while, finally extracting her copy of their old school textbook, A History of Magic by Matilda Bagshot, which she thumbed through until finding the page she wanted.
Upon the signature of the International Statute of Secrecy in 1689, wizards went into hiding for good. It was natural, perhaps, that they formed their own small communities within a community. Many small villages and hamlets attracted several magical families who banded together for mutual support and protection. The villages of Tinworth in Cornwall, Upper Flagley in Yorkshire, and Ottery St. Catchpole on the south coast of England were notable homes to knots of wizarding families who lived alongside tolerant and sometimes confounded muggles. Most celebrated of these half-magical dwelling places is, perhaps, Godric's Hollow, the West Country village where the great wizard Godric Gryffindor was born, and where Bowman Wright, wizarding smith, forged the first golden snitch. The graveyard is full of the names of ancient magical families, and this accounts, no doubt, for the stories of hauntings that have dogged the little church beside it for many centuries.
You and your parents aren't mentioned, Hermione said, closing the book.
Because Professor Bagshot doesn't cover anything later than the end of the 19th century. But you see, Godric's Hollow, Godric Gryffindor, Gryffindor's sword. Don't you think Dumbledore would have expected you to make the connection?
Oh, yeah. Harry did not want to admit that he had not been thinking about the sword at all when he suggested they go to Godric's Hollow. For him, the lure of the village lay in his parents' graves, the house where he had narrowly escaped death, and in the person of Matilda Bagshot.
Remember what Muriel said? He asked eventually. Who? You know?
He hesitated. He did not want to say Ron's name.
Ginny's great aunt, at the wedding, the one who said you had skinny ankles. Oh, said Hermione.
It was a sticky moment. Harry knew that she had sensed Ron's name in the offing. He rushed on.
She said Matilda Bagshot still lives in Godric's Hollow. Matilda Bagshot,
murmured Hermione, running her index finger over Matilda's embossed name on the front cover of A History of Magic.
Well, I suppose...
She gasped so dramatically that Harry's insides turned over. He drew his wand, looking around at the entrance, half expecting to see a hand forcing its way through the entrance flap. But there was nothing there.
What?
He said, half angry, half relieved.
What did you do that for?
I thought you'd seen a Death Eater unzipping the tent, at least.
Harry, what if Petilda's got the sword? What if Dumbledore entrusted it to her?
Harry considered this possibility. Petilda would be an extremely old woman by now, and according to Muriel, she was gaga. Was it likely that Dumbledore would have hidden the sword of Gryffindor with her? If so, Harry felt that Dumbledore had left a great deal to chance. Dumbledore had never revealed that he had replaced the sword with a fake, nor had he so much as mentioned a friendship with Petilda. Now, however, was not the moment to cast doubt on Hermione's theory, not when she was so surprisingly willing to fall in with Harry's dearest wish. Yeah, he might have done. So, are we going to go to Godric's Hollow?
Yes, but we'll have to think it through carefully, Harry.
She was sitting up now, and Harry could tell that the prospect of having a plan again had lifted her mood as much as his.
We'll need to practice disapparating together under the invisibility cloak for a start, and perhaps disillusionment charms would be sensible too, unless you think we should go the whole hog and use Polyjuice potion. In that case, we'll need to collect hair from somebody. I actually think we'd better do that, Harry. The thicker our disguises, the better.
Harry let her talk, nodding and agreeing whenever there was a pause, but his mind had left the conversation. For the first time since he had discovered that the sword in Gringotts was a fake, he felt excited. He was about to go home, about to return to the place where he had had a family. It was in Godric's Hollow that, but for Voldemort, he would have grown up and spent every school holiday. He could have invited friends to his house. He might even have had brothers and sisters. It would have been his mother who had made his 17th birthday cake. The life he had lost had hardly ever seemed so real to him as at this moment, when he knew he was about to see the place where it had been taken from him. After Hermione had gone to bed that night, Harry quietly extracted his rucksack from Hermione's beaded bag, and from inside it the photograph album Hagrid had given him so long ago. For the first time in months, he perused the old pictures of his parents, smiling and waving up at him from the images, which were all he had left of them now. Harry would gladly have set out for Godric's Hollow the following day, but Hermione had other ideas. Convinced, as she was, that Voldemort would expect Harry to return to the scene of his parents' deaths, she was determined that they would set off only after they had ensured that they had the best disguises possible. It was therefore a full week later, once they had surreptitiously obtained hairs from innocent muggles who were Christmas shopping, and had practiced apparating and disapparating while underneath the invisibility cloak together, that Hermione agreed to make the journey. They were to apparate to the village under cover of darkness, so it was late afternoon when they finally swallowed Polyjuice potion, Harry transforming into a balding, middle-aged muggle man, Hermione into his small and rather mousy wife. The beaded bag containing all of their possessions, apart from the Horcrux which Harry was wearing around his neck, was tucked into an inside pocket of Hermione's buttoned-up coat. Harry lowered the invisibility cloak over them, then they turned into the suffocating darkness once again. Heart beating in his throat, Harry opened his eyes. They were standing hand in hand in a snowy lane under a dark blue sky, in which the night's first stars were already glimmering feebly. Cottages stood on either side of the narrow road, Christmas decorations twinkling in their windows. A short way ahead of them, a glow of golden streetlights indicated the center of the village.
"All this snow," Hermione whispered beneath the cloak. "Why didn't we think of snow? After all our precautions, we'll leave friends. We'll just have to get rid of them. You go in front. I'll do it."
Harry did not want to enter the village like a pantomime horse, trying to keep themselves concealed while magically covering their traces.
"Let's take off the cloak," said Harry,
and when she looked frightened,
"Oh, come on, we don't look like us, and there's no one around."
He stowed the cloak under his jacket, and they made their way forward unhampered, the icy air stinging their faces as they passed more cottages. Any one of them might have been the one in which James and Lily had once lived, or where Matilda lived now. Harry gazed at the front doors, their snow-burdened roofs, and their front porches, wondering whether he remembered any of them, knowing deep inside that it was impossible, that he had been little more than a year old when he had left this place forever. He was not even sure whether he would be able to see the cottage at all. He did not know what happened when the subjects of a Fidelius charm died. Then the little lane along which they were walking curved to the left, and the heart of the village, a small square, was revealed to them. Strung all around with coloured lights, there was what looked like a war memorial in the middle, partly obscured by a wind-blown Christmas tree. There were several shops, a post office, a pub, and a little church whose stained glass windows were glowing jewel bright across the square. The snow here had become impacted. It was hard and slippery where people had trodden on it all day. Villagers were crisscrossing in front of them, their figures briefly illuminated by street lamps. They heard a snatch of laughter and pop music as the pub door opened and closed. Then they heard a carol start up inside the little church.
"Harry, I think it's Christmas Eve," said Hermione.
"Is it?"
He had lost track of the date. They had not seen a newspaper for weeks.
"I'm sure it is,"
said Hermione, her eyes upon the church.
They'll be in there, won't they? Your mum and dad. I can see the graveyard behind it."
Harry felt a thrill of something that was beyond excitement, more like fear. Now that he was so near, he wondered whether he wanted to see after all. Perhaps Hermione knew how he was feeling, because she reached for his hand and took the lead for the first time, pulling him forward. Halfway across the square, however, she stopped dead.
"Harry, look!"
She was pointing at the war memorial. As they had passed it, it had transformed. Instead of an obelisk, covered in names, there was a statue of three people, a man with untidy hair and glasses, a woman with long hair and a kind, pretty face, and a baby boy sitting in his mother's arms. Snow lay upon all their heads like fluffy white caps. Harry drew closer, gazing up into his parents' faces. He had never imagined that there would be a statue. How strange it was to see himself represented in stone, a happy baby without a scar on his forehead.
"Come on,"
said Harry when he had looked his fill, and they turned again toward the church. As they crossed the road, he glanced over his shoulder. The statue had turned back into the war memorial. The singing grew louder as they approached the church. It made Harry's throat constrict. It reminded him so forcefully of Hogwarts, of Peeves bellowing rude versions of carols from inside suits of armour, of the Great Hall's 12 Christmas trees, of Dumbledore wearing a bonnet he had won in a cracker, of Ron in a hand-knitted sweater. There was a kissing gate at the entrance to the graveyard. Hermione pushed it open as quietly as possible, and they edged through it. On either side of the slippery path to the church doors, the snow lay deep and untouched. They moved off through the snow, carving deep trenches behind them as they walked around the building, keeping to the shadows beneath the brilliant windows. Behind the church, row upon row of snowy tombstones protruded from a blanket of pale blue that was flecked with dazzling red, gold, and green wherever the reflections from the stained glass hit the snow. Keeping his hand closed tightly on the wand in his jacket pocket, Harry moved toward the nearest grave.
"Look at this. It's an abbot. Could be some long-lost relation of Hannah's. Keep your voice down,"
Hermione begged him. They waded deeper and deeper into the graveyard, gouging dark tracks into the snow behind them, stooping to peer at the words on old headstones, every now and then squinting into the surrounding darkness to make absolutely sure that they were unaccompanied.
"Harry, here."
Hermione was two rows of tombstones away. He had to wade back to her, his heart positively banging in his chest.
"Is it?" "No, but look."
She pointed to the dark stone. Harry stooped down and saw, upon the frozen lichen-spotted granite, the words Kendra Dumbledore and, a short way below her dates of birth and death, and her daughter Ariana. There was also a quotation. "Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." So Rita Skeeter and Muriel had got some of their facts right. The Dumbledore family had indeed lived here, and part of it had died here. Seeing the grave was worse than hearing about it. Harry could not help thinking that he and Dumbledore both had deep roots in this graveyard, and that Dumbledore ought to have told him so, yet he had never thought to share the connection. They could have visited the place together. For a moment, Harry imagined coming here with Dumbledore, of what a bond that would have been, of how much it would have meant to him. But it seemed that to Dumbledore, the fact that their families lay side by side in the same graveyard had been an unimportant coincidence, irrelevant perhaps to the job he wanted Harry to do. Hermione was looking at Harry, and he was glad that his face was hidden in shadow. He read the words on the tombstone again. "Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." He did not understand what these words meant. Surely Dumbledore had chosen them as the eldest member of the family once his mother had died.
"Are you sure he never mentioned?"
Hermione began.
"No,"
said Harry curtly. Then,
"Let's keep looking."
And he turned away, wishing he had not seen the stone. He did not want his excited trepidation tainted with resentment.
"Here!"
cried Hermione again a few moments later, from out of the darkness.
"Oh, no, sorry. I thought it said Potter."
She was rubbing at a crumbling, mossy stone, gazing down at it, a little frown on her face.
"Harry, come back a moment."
He did not want to be sidetracked again, and only grudgingly made his way back through the snow toward her.
"Wow.
Look at this."
The grave was extremely old, weathered so that Harry could hardly make out the name. Hermione showed him the symbol beneath it.
"Harry, that's the mark in the book."
He peered at the place she indicated. The stone was so worn that it was hard to make out what was engraved there, though there did seem to be a triangular mark beneath the nearly illegible name.
"Yeah, it could be."
Hermione lit her wand and pointed it at the name on the headstone.
"It says Ignotus, I think."
"I'm going to keep looking for my parents, all right?"
Harry told her, a slight edge to his voice, and he set off again, leaving her crouched beside the old grave. Every now and then he recognized a surname that, like Abbott, he had met at Hogwarts. Sometimes there were several generations of the same wizarding family represented in the graveyard. Harry could tell from the dates that it had either died out or the current members had moved away from Godric's Hollow. Deeper and deeper amongst the graves he went, and every time he reached a new headstone, he felt a little lurch of apprehension and anticipation. The darkness and the silence seemed to become, all of a sudden, much deeper. Harry looked around, worried, thinking of Dementors, then realized that the carols had finished, that the chatter and flurry of churchgoers were fading away as they made their way back into the square. Somebody inside the church had just turned off the lights. Then Hermione's voice came out of the blackness for the third time, sharp and clear from a few yards away.
"Harry, they're here. Right here."
And he knew by her tone that it was his mother and father this time. He moved toward her, feeling as if something heavy were pressing on his chest. The same sensation he had had right after Dumbledore had died, a grief that had actually weighed on his heart and lungs. The headstone was only two rows behind Kendra and Ariana's. It was made of white marble, just like Dumbledore's tomb, and this made it easy to read, as it seemed to shine in the dark. Harry did not need to kneel or even approach very close to it to make out the words engraved upon it. "James Potter, born 27 March 1960, died 31 October 1981. Lily Potter, born 30 January 1960, died 31 October 1981. The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death." Harry read the words slowly, as though he would have only one chance to take in their meaning, and he read the last of them aloud.
"The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death."
A horrible thought came to him, and with it a kind of panic.
"Isn't that a Death Eater idea? Why is that there? It doesn't mean defeating death in the way the Death Eaters mean it, Harry,"
said Hermione, her voice gentle.
"It means, you know, living beyond death, living after death."
But they were not living, thought Harry. They were gone. The empty words could not disguise the fact that his parents' mouldering remains lay beneath snow and stone, indifferent, unknowing. And tears came before he could stop them. Boiling hot, then instantly freezing on his face. And what was the point in wiping them off or pretending? He let them fall, his lips pressed hard together, looking down at the thick snow, hiding from his eyes the place where the last of Lily and James lay. Bones now, surely, or dust, not knowing or caring that their living son stood so near. His heart still beating, alive because of their sacrifice, and close to wishing, at this moment, that he was sleeping under the snow with them. Hermione had taken his hand again and was gripping it tightly. He could not look at her but returned the pressure, now taking deep, sharp gulps of the night air, trying to steady himself, trying to regain control. He should have brought something to give them, and he had not thought of it, and every plant in the graveyard was leafless and frozen. But Hermione raised her wand, moved it in a circle through the air, and a wreath of Christmas roses blossomed before them. Harry caught it and laid it on his parents' grave. As soon as he stood up, he wanted to leave. He did not think he could stand another moment there. He put his arm around Hermione's shoulders, and she put hers around his waist, and they turned in silence and walked away through the snow, past Dumbledore's mother and sister, back toward the dark church and the out-of-sight kissing gate. Chapter 17. Matilda's Secret.
Harry, stop! What's wrong?
They had only just reached the grave of the unknown abbot.
There's someone there. Someone watching us. I can tell. There, over by the bushes.
They stood quite still, holding on to each other, gazing at the dense black boundary of the graveyard. Harry could not see anything.
Are you sure? I saw something move. I could have sworn I did.
She broke from him to free her wand arm.
We look like muggles,
Harry pointed out.
Muggles who've just been laying flowers on your parents' grave. Harry, I'm sure there's someone over there.
Harry thought of A History of Magic. The graveyard was supposed to be haunted.
What if...
But then he heard a rustle and saw a little eddy of dislodged snow in the bush to which Hermione had pointed. Ghosts could not move snow.
It's a cat,
said Harry after a second or two.
Or a bird. If it was a Death Eater, we'd be dead by now. But let's get out of here and we can put the cloak back on.
They glanced back repeatedly as they made their way out of the graveyard. Harry, who did not feel as sanguine as he had pretended when reassuring Hermione, was glad to reach the gate and the slippery pavement. They pulled the invisibility cloak back over themselves. The pub was fuller than before. Many voices inside it were now singing the carol that they had heard as they approached the church. For a moment, Harry considered suggesting they take refuge inside it, but before he could say anything, Hermione murmured,
"Let's go this way,"
and pulled him down the dark street leading out of the village in the opposite direction from which they had entered. Harry could make out the point where the cottages ended, and the lane turned into open country again. They walked as quickly as they dared, past more windows sparkling with multicolored lights, the outlines of Christmas trees dark through the curtains.
"How are we going to find Matilda's house?"
asked Hermione, who was shivering a little and kept glancing back over her shoulder.
"Harry? What do you think? Harry?"
She tugged at his arm, but Harry was not paying attention. He was looking toward the dark mass that stood at the very end of this row of houses. Next moment he had sped up, dragging Hermione along with him. She slipped a little on the ice.
"Harry! Look! Look at it, Hermione! I don't... Oh!"
He could see it. The Fidelius charm must have died with James and Lily. The hedge had grown wild in the 16 years since Hagrid had taken Harry from the rubble that lay scattered amongst the waist-high grass. Most of the cottage was still standing, though entirely covered in dark ivy and snow. But the right side of the top floor had been blown apart. That, Harry was sure, was where the curse had backfired. He and Hermione stood at the gate, gazing up at the wreck of what must once have been a cottage just like those that flanked it.
"I wonder why nobody's ever rebuilt it,"
whispered Hermione.
"Maybe they can't rebuild it,"
Harry replied.
"Maybe it's like the injuries from dark magic, and you can't repair the damage."
He slipped a hand from beneath the cloak and grasped the snowy and thickly rusted gate, not wishing to open it, but simply to hold some part of the house.
You're not going to go inside. It looks unsafe. It might. Oh, Harry, look.
His touch on the gate seemed to have done it. A sign had risen out of the ground in front of them, up through the tangles of nettles and weeds, like some bizarre fast-growing flower, and in golden letters upon the wood it said, "On this spot, on the night of 31 October 1981, Lily and James Potter lost their lives. Their son, Harry, remains the only wizard ever to have survived the killing curse. This house, invisible to muggles, has been left in its ruined state as a monument to the Potters and as a reminder of the violence that tore apart their family." And all around these neatly lettered words, scribbles had been added by other witches and wizards who had come to see the place where the boy who lived had escaped. Some had merely signed their names in everlasting ink. Others had carved their initials into the wood. Still others had left messages. The most recent of these, shining brightly over 16 years' worth of magical graffiti, all said similar things.
"Good luck, Harry, wherever you are."
"If you read this, Harry, we're all behind you."
"Long live Harry Potter!"
"They shouldn't have written on the sign,"
said Hermione, indignant. But Harry beamed at her.
"It's brilliant. I'm glad they did. I..."
He broke off. A heavily muffled figure was hobbling up the lane toward them, silhouetted by the bright lights in the distant square. Harry thought, though it was hard to judge, that the figure was a woman. She was moving slowly, possibly frightened of slipping on the snowy ground. Her stoop, her stoutness, her shuffling gait, all gave an impression of extreme age. They watched in silence as she drew nearer. Harry was waiting to see whether she would turn into any of the cottages she was passing, but he knew instinctively that she would not. At last, she came to a halt a few yards from them, and simply stood there in the middle of the frozen road, facing them. He did not need Hermione's pinch to his arm. There was next to no chance that this woman was a muggle. She was standing there gazing at a house that ought to have been completely invisible to her if she was not a witch. Even assuming that she was a witch, however, it was odd behavior to come out on a night this cold simply to look at an old ruin. By all the rules of normal magic, meanwhile, she ought not to be able to see Hermione and him at all. Nevertheless, Harry had the strangest feeling that she knew that they were there, and also who they were. Just as he had reached this uneasy conclusion, she raised a gloved hand and beckoned. Hermione moved closer to him under the cloak, her arm pressed against his.
"How does she know?"
He shook his head. The woman beckoned again, more vigorously. Harry could think of many reasons not to obey the summons, and yet his suspicions about her identity were growing stronger every moment that they stood facing each other in the deserted street. Was it possible that she had been waiting for them all these long months, that Dumbledore had told her to wait, and that Harry would come in the end? Was it not likely that it was she who had moved in the shadows in the graveyard and had followed them to this spot? Even her ability to sense them suggested some Dumbledore-ish power that he had never encountered before. Finally, Harry spoke, causing Hermione to gasp and jump.
"Are you Matilda?"
The muffled figure nodded and beckoned again. Beneath the cloak, Harry and Hermione looked at each other. Harry raised his eyebrows. Hermione gave a tiny, nervous nod. They stepped toward the woman, and at once she turned and hobbled off back the way they had come. Leading them past several houses, she turned in at a gate. They followed her up the front path, through a garden nearly as overgrown as the one they had just left. She fumbled for a moment with a key at the front door, then opened it and stepped back to let them pass. She smelled bad, or perhaps it was her house. Harry wrinkled his nose as they sidled past her and pulled off the cloak. Now that he was beside her, he realized how tiny she was. Bowed down with age, she came barely level with his chest. She closed the door behind them, her knuckles blue and mottled against the peeling paint, then turned and peered into Harry's face. Her eyes were thick with cataracts and sunken into folds of transparent skin, and her whole face was dotted with broken veins and liver spots. He wondered whether she could make him out at all. Even if she could, it was the balding muggle whose identity he had stolen that she would see. The odor of old age, of dust, of unwashed clothes and stale food intensified as she unwound a moth-eaten black shawl, revealing a head of scant white hair through which the scalp showed clearly.
"Batilda?" Harry repeated.
She nodded again. Harry became aware of the locket against his skin, the thing inside it that sometimes ticked or beat had woken. He could feel it pulsing through the cold gold. Did it know, could it sense that the thing that would destroy it was near? Batilda shuffled past them, pushing Hermione aside as though she had not seen her, and vanished into what seemed to be a sitting room.
"Harry, I'm not sure about this," breathed Hermione.
"Look at the size of her. I think we could overpower her if we had to," said Harry.
"Listen, I should have told you. I knew she wasn't all there. Muriel called her Gaga."
"Come,"
called Batilda from the next room. Hermione jumped and clutched Harry's arm.
"It's okay," said Harry reassuringly, and he led the way into the sitting room.
Batilda was tottering around the place lighting candles, but it was still very dark, not to mention extremely dirty. Thick dust crunched beneath their feet, and Harry's nose detected, underneath the dank and mildewed smell, something worse, like meat gone bad. He wondered when was the last time anyone had been inside Batilda's house to check whether she was coping. She seemed to have forgotten that she could do magic, too, for she lit the candles clumsily by hand, her trailing lace cuff in constant danger of catching fire.
"Let me do that,"
offered Harry, and he took the matches from her. She stood watching him as he finished lighting the candle stubs that stood on saucers around the room, perched precariously on stacks of books and on side tables crammed with cracked and moldy cups. The last surface on which Harry spotted a candle was a bow-fronted chest of drawers on which there stood a large number of photographs. When the flame danced into life, its reflection wavered on their dusty glass and silver. He saw a few tiny movements from the pictures. As Batilda fumbled with logs for the fire, he muttered,
"Curgio."
The dust vanished from the photographs, and he saw at once that half a dozen were missing from the largest and most ornate frames. He wondered whether Batilda or somebody else had removed them. Then the sight of a photograph near the back of the collection caught his eye, and he snatched it up. It was the golden-haired, merry-faced thief, the young man who had perched on Grigorovich's windowsill, smiling lazily up at Harry out of the silver frame. And it came to Harry instantly where he had seen the boy before, in The Life and Lies of Albus Dumbledore, arm in arm with the teenage Dumbledore, and that must be where all the missing photographs were, in Rita's book.
"Mrs. Miss Bagshot,"
he said, and his voice shook slightly.
"Who is this?"
Batilda was standing in the middle of the room watching Hermione light the fire for her.
"Miss Bagshot?"
Harry repeated, and he advanced with the picture in his hands as the flames burst into life in the fireplace. Batilda looked up at his voice, and the horcrux beat faster upon his chest.
"Who is this person?"
Harry asked her, pushing the picture forward. She peered at it solemnly, then up at Harry.
"Do you know who this is?"
he repeated, in a much slower and louder voice than usual.
"This man? Do you know him? What's he called?"
Batilda merely looked vague. Harry felt an awful frustration. How had Rita Skeeter unlocked Batilda's memories?
"Who is this man?"
he repeated loudly.
"Harry, what are you doing?"
asked Hermione.
"This picture, Hermione, it's the thief. The thief who stole from Grigorovich. Please,"
he said to Batilda.
"Who is this?"
But she only stared at him.
"Why did you ask us to come with you, Miss Bagshot?"
asked Hermione, raising her own voice.
"Was there something you wanted to tell us?"
Giving no sign that she had heard Hermione, Batilda now shuffled a few steps closer to Harry. With a little jerk of her head, she looked back into the hall.
"You want us to leave?"
he asked. She repeated the gesture. this time pointing firstly at him, then at herself, then at the ceiling.
Oh, right. Hermione, I think she wants me to go upstairs with her.
All right,
said Hermione.
Let's go.
But when Hermione moved, Matilda shook her head with surprising vigor, once more pointing first at Harry, then to herself.
She wants me to go with her alone.
Why?
Asked Hermione, and her voice rang out sharp and clear in the candlelit room. The old lady shook her head a little at the loud noise.
Maybe Dumbledore told her to give the sword to me, and only to me.
Do you really think she knows who you are?
Yes,
said Harry, looking down into the milky eyes fixed upon his own.
I think she does.
Well, okay then, but be quick, Harry.
Lead the way,
Harry told Matilda. She seemed to understand, because she shuffled around him toward the door. Harry glanced back at Hermione with a reassuring smile, but he was not sure she had seen it. She stood hugging herself in the midst of the candle-lit squalor, looking toward the bookcase. As Harry walked out of the room, unseen by both Hermione and Matilda, he slipped the silver-framed photograph of the unknown thief inside his jacket. The stairs were steep and narrow. Harry was half tempted to place his hands on stout Matilda's backside to ensure that she did not topple over backward on top of him, which seemed only too likely. Slowly, wheezing a little, she climbed to the upper landing, turned immediately right, and led him into a low-ceilinged bedroom. It was pitch black and smelled horrible. Harry had just made out a chamber pot protruding from under the bed before Matilda closed the door, and even that was swallowed by the darkness.
Lumos,
said Harry, and his wand ignited. He gave a start. Matilda had moved close to him in those few seconds of darkness, and he had not heard her approach.
You are Potter,
she whispered.
Yes, I am.
She nodded slowly, solemnly. Harry felt the Horcrux beating fast, faster than his own heart. It was an unpleasant, agitating sensation.
Have you got anything for me?
Harry asked, but she seemed distracted by his lit wand tip.
Have you got anything for me?
He repeated. Then she closed her eyes and several things happened at once. Harry's scar prickled painfully. The Horcrux twitched so that the front of his sweater actually moved. The dark, fetid room dissolved momentarily. He felt a leap of joy and spoke in a high, cold voice.
Hold him!
Harry swayed where he stood. The dark, foul-smelling room seemed to close around him again. He did not know what had just happened.
Have you got anything for me?
He asked for a third time, much louder.
Over here,
she whispered, pointing to the corner. Harry raised his wand and saw the outline of a cluttered dressing table beneath the curtained window. This time she did not lead him. Harry edged between her and the unmade bed, his wand raised. He did not want to look away from her.
What is it?
He asked as he reached the dressing table, which was heaped high with what looked and smelled like dirty laundry. She said, pointing at the shapeless mass. And in the instant that he looked away, his eyes raking the tangled mess for a sword hilt, a ruby, she moved weirdly. He saw it out of the corner of his eye. Panic made him turn, and horror paralyzed him as he saw the old body collapsing and the great snake pouring from the place where her neck had been. The snake struck as he raised his wand. The force of the bite to his forearm sent the wand spinning up toward the ceiling. Its light swung dizzyingly around the room and was extinguished. Then a powerful blow from the tail to his midriff knocked the breath out of him. He fell backward onto the dressing table, into the mound of filthy clothing. He rolled sideways, narrowly avoiding the snake's tail, which thrashed down upon the table where he had been a second earlier. Fragments of the glass surface rained upon him as he hit the floor. From below, he heard Hermione call,
"Hurry!"
He could not get enough breath into his lungs to call back. Then a heavy, smooth mass smashed him to the floor, and he felt it slide over him, powerful, muscular.
No!
He gasped, pinned to the floor.
Yes,
whispered the voice.
Yes, hold you, hold you. Asio! Asio wand!
But nothing happened, and he needed his hands to try to force the snake from him as it coiled itself around his torso, squeezing the air from him, pressing the horcrux hard into his chest, a circle of ice that throbbed with life inches from his own frantic heart. And his brain was flooding with cold, white light, all thought obliterated, his own breath drowned, distant footsteps, everything going. A metal heart was banging outside his chest, and now he was flying, flying with triumph in his heart, without need of broomstick or thestral. He was abruptly awake in the sour-smelling darkness. Nagini had released him. He scrambled up and saw the snake outlined against the landing light. It struck, and Hermione dived aside with a shriek. Her deflected curse hit the curtained window, which shattered. Frozen air filled the room as Harry ducked to avoid another shower of broken glass, and his foot slipped on a pencil like something. His wand! He bent and snatched it up, but now the room was full of the snake, its tail thrashing. Hermione was nowhere to be seen, and for a moment Harry thought the worst. But then there was a loud bang and a flash of red light, and the snake flew into the air, smacking Harry hard in the face as it went, coil after heavy coil rising up to the ceiling. Harry raised his wand, but as he did so, his scar seared more painfully, more powerfully than it had done in years.
"He's coming! Hermione, he's coming!"
As he yelled, the snake fell, hissing wildly. Everything was chaos. It smashed shelves from the wall, and splintered china flew everywhere as Harry jumped over the bed and seized the dark shape he knew to be Hermione. She shrieked with pain as he pulled her back across the bed. The snake reared again, but Harry knew that worse than the snake was coming, was perhaps already at the gate. His head was going to split open with the pain from his scar. The snake lunged as he took a running leap, dragging Hermione with him. As it struck, Hermione screamed,
"Confringo!"
And her spell flew around the room, exploding the wardrobe mirror and ricocheting back at them, bouncing from floor to ceiling. Harry felt the heat of it sear the back of his hand. Glass cut his cheek as, pulling Hermione with him, he leapt from bed to broken dressing table and then straight out of the smashed window into nothingness, her scream reverberating through the night as they twisted in midair. And then his scar burst open. And he was Voldemort, and he was running across the fetid bedroom, his long white hands clutching at the windowsill as he glimpsed the bald man and the little woman twist and vanish. And he screamed with rage, a scream that mingled with the girls, that echoed across the dark gardens over the church bells ringing in Christmas Day. And his scream was Harry's scream. His pain was Harry's pain, that it could happen here. Where it had happened before, here, within sight of that house where he had come so close to knowing what it was to die. To die. The pain was so terrible, ripped from his body. But if he had no body, why did his head hurt so badly? If he was dead, how could he feel so unbearably? Didn't pain cease with death? Didn't it go? The night, wet and windy, two children dressed as pumpkins waddling across the square, and the shop windows covered in paper spiders, all the tawdry muggle trappings of a world in which they did not believe. And he was gliding along, that sense of purpose and power and rightness in him that he always knew on these occasions. Not anger, that was for weaker souls than he, but triumph. Yes, he had waited for this, he had hoped for it.
"Nice costume, mister."
He saw the small boy's smile falter as he ran near enough to see beneath the hood of the cloak, saw the fear cloud his painted face. Then the child turned and ran away. Beneath the robe he fingered the handle of his wand. One simple movement and the child would never reach his mother. But unnecessary, quite unnecessary. And along a new and darker street he moved, and now his destination was in sight at last. The Fidelius charm broken, though they did not know it yet, and he made less noise than the dead leaves slithering along the pavement as he drew level with the dark hedge and stared over it. They had not drawn the curtains. He saw them quite clearly in their little sitting room, the tall black-haired man in his glasses making puffs of coloured smoke erupt from his wand for the amusement of the small black-haired boy in his blue pyjamas. The child was laughing and trying to catch the smoke, to grab it in his small fist. The door opened and the mother entered, saying words he could not hear, her long dark red hair falling over her face. Now the father scooped up the son and handed him to the mother. He threw his wand down upon the sofa and stretched, yawning. The gate creaked a little as he pushed it open, but James Potter did not hear. His white hand pulled out the wand beneath his cloak and pointed it at the door, which burst open. He was over the threshold as James came sprinting into the hall. It was easy, too easy. He had not even picked up his wand.
"Lily, take Harry and go. It's him. Go, run. I'll hold him off."
Hold him off without a wand in his hand? He laughed before casting the curse.
Avada Kedavra!
The green light filled the cramped hallway. It lit the pram pushed against the wall. It made the banisters glare like lightning rods, and James Potter fell like a marionette whose strings were cut. He could hear her screaming from the upper floor, trapped, but as long as she was sensible, she, at least, had nothing to fear. He climbed the steps, listening with faint amusement to her attempts to barricade herself in. She had no wand upon her either.
How stupid they were, and how trusting, thinking that their safety lay in friends, that weapons could be discarded even for moments.
He forced the door open, cast aside the chair and boxes hastily piled against it with one lazy wave of his wand. And there she stood, the child in her arms. At the sight of him, she dropped her son into the crib behind her and threw her arms wide, as if this would help, as if in shielding him from sight, she hoped to be chosen instead.
"Not Harry! Not Harry! Please, not Harry!" "Stand aside, you silly girl! Stand aside now!" "Not Harry! Please, no! Take me! Kill me instead!" "This is my last warning!" "Not Harry, please! Have mercy! Have mercy! Not Harry! Not Harry, please! I'll do anything! Stand aside! Stand aside, girl!"
He could have forced her away from the crib, but it seemed more prudent to finish them all. The green light flashed around the room, and she dropped like her husband. The child had not cried all this time. He could stand, clutching the bars of his crib, and he looked up into the intruder's face with a kind of bright interest, perhaps thinking that it was his father who hid beneath the cloak, making more pretty lights, and his mother would pop up any moment, laughing. He pointed the wand very carefully into the boy's face. He wanted to see it happen, the destruction of this one inexplicable danger. The child began to cry. It had seen that he was not James. He did not like it crying. He had never been able to stomach the small ones whining in the orphanage.
"Avada Kedavra!"
And then he broke. He was nothing, nothing but pain and terror. And he must hide himself, not here in the rubble of the ruined house where the child was trapped and screaming, but far away, far away.
"No!"
he moaned. The snake rustled on the filthy, cluttered floor, and he had killed the boy. And yet, he was the boy.
"No."
And now he stood at the broken window of Batilda's house, immersed in memories of his greatest loss. And at his feet, the great snake slithered over broken china and glass. He looked down and saw something, something incredible.
"No!" "Harry, it's all right. You're all right."
He stooped down and picked up the smashed photograph. There he was, the unknown thief, the thief he was seeking.
"No, I chopped it. I chopped it. Harry, it's okay. Wake up. Wake up."
He was Harry. Harry, not Voldemort. And the thing that was rustling was not a snake. He opened his eyes.
"Harry,"
Hermione whispered,
"do you feel all right?"
"Yes," he lied. He was in the tent, lying on one of the lower bunks beneath a heap of blankets. He could tell that it was almost dawn by the stillness and the quality of the cold, flat light beyond the canvas ceiling. He was drenched in sweat. He could feel it on the sheets and blankets.
We got away.
Yes, said Hermione. I had to use a hover charm to get you into your bunk. I couldn't lift you. You've been... Well, you haven't been quite... There were purple shadows under her brown eyes, and he noticed a small sponge in her hand. She had been wiping his face.
You've been ill, she finished. Quite ill.
How long ago did we leave?
Hours ago. It's nearly morning.
And I've been, what, unconscious?
Not exactly, said Hermione uncomfortably. You've been shouting and moaning and things,
she added in a tone that made Harry feel uneasy. What had he done? Screamed curses like Voldemort? Cried like the baby in the crib?
I couldn't get the Horcrux off you,
Hermione said, and he knew she wanted to change the subject.
It was stuck. Stuck to your chest. You've got a mark. I'm sorry. I had to use a severing charm to get it away. The snake bit you too, but I cleaned the wound and put some Dittany on it.
He pulled the sweaty T-shirt he was wearing away from himself and looked down. There was a scarlet oval over his heart where the locket had burned him. He could also see the half-healed puncture marks to his forearm.
Where have you put the Horcrux?
In my bag. I think we should keep it off for a while.
He lay back on his pillows and looked into her pinched grey face.
We shouldn't have gone to Godric's Hollow. It's my fault. It's all my fault, Hermione. I'm sorry.
It's not your fault. I wanted to go too. I really thought Dumbledore might have left the sword there for you.
Yeah. Well, we got that wrong, didn't we?
What happened, Harry? What happened when she took you upstairs? Was the snake hiding somewhere? Did it just come out and kill her and attack you?
No, he said. She was the snake, or the snake was her, all along.
What?
He closed his eyes. He could still smell Matilda's house on him. It made the whole thing horribly vivid. Matilda must have been dead a while. The snake was inside her. You know who put it there in Godric's Hollow to wait. You were right.
He knew I'd go back. The snake was inside her?
He opened his eyes again. Hermione looked revolted, nauseated. Lupin said there would be magic we'd never imagined, Harry said. She didn't want to talk in front of you because it was parcel tongue. All parcel tongue, and I didn't realize, but of course I could understand her. Once we were up in the room, the snake sent a message to you-know-who. I heard it happen inside my head. I felt him get excited. He said to keep me there. And then... He remembered the snake coming out of Matilda's neck. Hermione did not need to know the details.
She changed. Changed into the snake. And attacked.
He looked down at the puncture marks. It wasn't supposed to kill me. Just keep me there till you-know-who came. If he had only managed to kill the snake, it would have been worth it, all of it. Sick at heart, he sat up and threw back the covers.
Harry, no. I'm sure you ought to rest.
You're the one who needs sleep. No offense, but you look terrible. I'm fine. I'll keep watch for a while. Where's my wand? She did not answer. She merely looked at him. Where's my wand, Hermione? She was biting her lip, and tears swam in her eyes.
Harry,
where's my wand? She reached down beside the bed and held it out to him. The holly and phoenix wand was nearly severed in two. One fragile strand of phoenix feather kept both pieces hanging together. The wood had splintered apart completely. Harry took it into his hands as though it was a living thing that had suffered a terrible injury. He could not think properly. Everything was a blur of panic and fear. Then he held out the wand to Hermione. Mend it, please.
Harry, I don't think when it's broken like this.
Please, Hermione, try.
Ribeiro.
The dangling half of the wand resealed itself. Harry held it up. Lumos! The wand sparked feebly, then went out. Harry pointed it at Hermione.
Expelliarmus!
Hermione's wand gave a little jerk, but did not leave her hand. The feeble attempt at magic was too much for Harry's wand, which split into two again. He stared at it, aghast, unable to take in what he was seeing. The wand that had survived so much.
Harry,
Hermione whispered so quietly he could hardly hear her. I'm so, so sorry. I think it was me. As we were leaving, you know, the snake was coming for us, and so I cast a blasting curse, and it rebounded everywhere, and it must have hit.
It was an accident, said Harry mechanically. He felt empty, stunned. We'll find a way to repair it.
Harry, I don't think we're going to be able to, said Hermione, the tears trickling down her face. Remember Ron? When he broke his wand, crashing the car? It was never the same again. He had to get a new one.
Harry thought of Ollivander, kidnapped and held hostage by Voldemort, of Gregorovitch, who was dead. How was he supposed to find himself a new wand? Well, he said, in a falsely matter-of-fact voice, well, I'll just borrow yours for now, then, while I keep watch. Her face glazed with tears. Hermione handed over her wand, and he left her sitting beside his bed, desiring nothing more than to get away from her. Chapter 18. The Life and Lies of Albus Dumbledore. The sun was coming up. The pure, colourless vastness of the sky stretched over him, indifferent to him and his suffering. Harry sat down in the tent entrance and took a deep breath of clean air. Simply to be alive, to watch the sun rise over the sparkling snowy hillside, ought to have been the greatest treasure on earth. Yet he could not appreciate it. His senses had been spiked by the calamity of losing his wand. He looked out over a valley blanketed in snow, distant church bells chiming through the glittering silence. Without realizing it, he was digging his fingers into his arms as if he were trying to resist physical pain. He had spilled his own blood more times than he could count. He had lost all the bones in his right arm once. This journey had already given him scars to his chest and forearm to join those on his hand and forehead. But never, until this moment, had he felt himself to be fatally weakened, vulnerable and naked, as though the best part of his magical power had been torn from him. He knew exactly what Hermione would say if he expressed any of this. The wand is only as good as the wizard. But she was wrong. His case was different. She had not felt the wand spin like the needle of a compass and shoot golden flames at his enemy. He had lost the protection of the twin cores, and only now that it was gone did he realize how much he had been counting upon it. He pulled the pieces of the broken wand out of his pocket and, without looking at them, tucked them away in Hagrid's pouch around his neck. The pouch was now too full of broken and useless objects to take any more. Harry's hand brushed the old snitch through the moleskin, and for a moment he had to fight the temptation to pull it out and throw it away. Impenetrable, unhelpful, useless, like everything else Dumbledore had left behind. And his fury at Dumbledore broke over him now like lava, scorching him inside, wiping out every other feeling. Out of sheer desperation, they had talked themselves into believing that Godric's Hollow held answers, convinced themselves that they were supposed to go back, that it was all part of some secret path laid out for them by Dumbledore. But there was no map, no plan. Dumbledore had left them to grope in the darkness, to wrestle with unknown and undreamed-of terrors, alone and unaided. Nothing was explained, nothing was given freely. They had no sword, and now Harry had no wand. And he had dropped the photograph of the thief, and it would surely be easy now for Voldemort to find out who he was. Voldemort had all the information now.
Harry?
Hermione looked frightened that he might curse her with her own wand. Her face streaked with tears, she crouched down beside him, two cups of tea trembling in her hands, and something bulky under her arm.
Thanks, he said, taking one of the cups. Do you mind if I talk to you?
No, he said, because he did not want to hurt her feelings.
Harry, you wanted to know who that man in the picture was. Well, I've got the book.
Timidly, she pushed it onto his lap, a pristine copy of The Life and Lies of Albus Dumbledore.
Where? How? It was in Batilda's sitting room, just lying there. This note was sticking out of the top of it.
Hermione read the few lines of spiky, acid-green writing aloud.
Dear Batty, thanks for your help. Here's a copy of the book. Hope you like it. You said everything, even if you don't remember it. Rita. I think it must have arrived while the real Batilda was alive. but perhaps she wasn't in any fit state to read it. No, she probably wasn't. Harry looked down upon Dumbledore's face and experienced a surge of savage pleasure. Now he would know all the things that Dumbledore had never thought it worth telling him, whether Dumbledore wanted him to or not. "You're still really angry at me, aren't you?" said her mother.